part two, short bursts, and then it also looks at non-burst sources, and we have been looking at quite a few supernovae with both the UV telescope and the X-ray telescope. And there's some interesting new results, just a couple of view graphs that I wanted to show you about that. So it's been a remarkable year. Certainly, at the beginning of this year, we knew of one way to make a gamma ray burst. And I would claim now we know three different ways to make a gamma ray burst, because there are also mergers and perhaps magnetars. And that also was learned in this last year. And there's I think there are a lot of similarities to supernovae. You know, certainly you guys are having this workshop joining the two. Not just in the long bursts, though, but in the fact that there's a class of bursts that you know, has to do with early stars, and another one that has late stars. And I think it's quite amazing that these very same is true for supernovae, that these very different physical mechanisms, in the case of bursts, there's three of them, can make a flash of gamma rays that looks pretty much the same. So start out with kind of rogue's gallery of all the bursts we've seen. Actually, it's not quite all of them. There's 96 on this page. And it's not to discuss any one of them in any detail, since you can hardly see it, but to show that about 10% of the bursts that we see are the short, hard gamma ray bursts. Those are shown in green. And then another 10% are X-ray flashes. And of course, the light curves for all these bursts are unique, and everyone's different from the next one. So start out by, what I'd like to do now is walk through the various short bursts that we have, and especially the ones that, you know, the ones that have the best observations. And I'll get to a table of all the bursts, different parameters that we're starting to learn. But I think, as you know, this is a very early business, and we're just beginning to understand. There's still a lot of questions about bursts, and I'll try to get into that, and that'll be an area I think will be good for discussion also. So this is the first burst, the first short burst that we localized on May the 9th. And I'd like to tell you a little bit how the operations work for SWIFT. Maybe interesting for you, and also help you if you are participating in observations, or even if you're a theorist and you like to watch the GCNs and coming out and try to understand what goes into those. So when a burst goes off and triggers SWIFT, the first thing that happens are all the data that we're collecting from the three instruments comes down over a TDRS link out onto the internet, and that automatically goes out to everybody as notices. It's on this GCN system that Scott Bartholomew at Goddard has developed, and basically sends out information on bursts out on the internet. And these notices go out autonomously. So we calculate the position on board for the bat. Of course, we need that for the spacecraft anyway. But we also calculate a centroid for the X-ray signal that we see. And if there is a UV optical detection, we send that out too. So within seconds, people have this data on their internet. And we even have socket connections to save those fractions of seconds that the you know, internet takes for people who have robotically slewing telescopes. So then the next thing that happens is, as these notices go out, we also get paged. There's a group of people on the SWIFT team that get paged. And we wake up if it's the middle of the night. This one was. More often, you know, it's more pleasant during the day. But it's even exciting at night, because you never know what nature is thrown at you. And this is the first chance to look. And we look at the data on our computers at home, usually. And then we send out a different thing on the GCN, which are the circulars. And these are the written in words paragraphs. And they say, they're kind of summary of what's come out on the notices. And they also give our thoughts on what's going on here. You can't tell from the notices if it was a short burst, or sometimes there's about 20% of the time we have a notice that goes out and it wasn't a gamma ray burst. It was a transient, or even in a few cases it's due to cosmic ray, and it's a non-event. So these circulars are important. Well, we got paged for this one in the middle of the night, and we got up. This was May, so it was almost a half a year after launch, and we'd been waiting patiently for the first short burst. And we'd had one in March, but we weren't slewing. We weren't able to slew to that one because of the constraint. And this one we slewed to. It was a very weak short burst, 2 times 10 to the minus 8 fluence. And luckily it was pretty close to the axis, so we got there quickly. And it was also extremely weak detection in the x-rays. So this is the first time that an afterglow had been detected, the first opportunity that we had to get an arc second position. And but we only got 11 photons from this. The whole time we looked with the x-ray telescope, we got 11 photons. Well, it's a focusing zero background instrument, so 11 compared to 1, that, you know, one would expect about 1 of photon background within the time we looked. That's highly significant. So, you know, we were able to see, and we could even see bending it up in a couple of bins that it was fading away. So we had an x-ray counterpart, and this is where it fell on the sky. Well, first of all, that's what the bat signal looked like. And this is the count rate in the different energy bands. And as you know, the short bursts have harder spectra. And we immediately noticed that there was almost nothing in the lowest energy band. And then it got hot, you know, more in the higher band. So it was a short, hard event. And it was very short, only 30 millisecond duration. This is the position on the sky from the bat. And then when we put on it the XRT position, it fell on top of this massive galaxy, an elliptical galaxy. And the whole time we've been following up long bursts, we've never had an error box fall on top of an elliptical galaxy. You know, they always fall on star-forming galaxies. This one has very low star formation. It actually turns out it's one of 2 CD galaxies in a cluster. It's a merging cluster, and there are 2 CD galaxies, you know, that will eventually probably merge, but this is one of them. It's in a 3 L-star galaxy. So from the very beginning, we knew that there was something, or we had a hint anyway, that there was something very different about short bursts and long bursts. Because you don't have any young massive stars, or there's very few anyway, young massive stars in an elliptical galaxy. Now, of course, the error circle is fairly large. Since there were just a few photons, it was 10 arc seconds in diameter. And there are other faint galaxies in the background, so it couldn't be absolutely proved that the burst was even coming from this elliptical galaxy. But there was a, you know, pretty, so we were looking, this is a different kind of burst, we thought there might be something different there, and there was, so it was certainly a smoking gun. Then the next short burst was localized by HETI. And this one, you know, first it seemed very confusing, because this burst was in a star-forming galaxy. There's the burst. And you can see it fading away over a series of images. This is a beautiful HST picture that was made. So I'll get it back to the first. So in this, I didn't mention the previous one was a redshift of 0.2. So that was also different from the long burst. It was closer by. This one had a redshift of 0.16. We looked at it with the XRT, Chandra looked at it, and the previous one, there were lots of searches for an optical transient, and none was found. In this case, there was. And then we got the HETI team got this very nice HST observation. Actually, that was Derek Fox's observation. And even though it is in a star-forming galaxy, there's some nebulosity in this region, but it tends to be in a fairly dark region. And so it's not inconsistent with a non-star formation model of the, you know, the origin of this burst. It could be due to a neutron star merger out here. There certainly are neutron star mergers occurring in star-forming galaxies. Another important thing here, we did it on the first burst, and it was done here even better. Deep observations were made, and no supernova signature was seen. And you say, well, there are lots of long bursts that didn't have a supernova seen at the same time. But all of the long bursts that were very close by had some kind of signature of an explosion, you know, after the burst, some kind of coincident supernova signature. And this one had nothing like that. Okay. We'll step forward to the next one. This one was a very important burst, I think, because it was detected by SWIFT on July 24th. We got a very good location because it was detected in the optical and in Chandra, and so it had a sub-arc second location. And once again, this one fell on an elliptical galaxy. Now the first one, the center of the XRT circle was offset from the center of the galaxy, but it was a big error circle, and the it even included the center. In this case, it's very clearly offset. And this is another piece of evidence in support of a merger kind of, because one would expect, we may want to discuss that ourselves, but some people would expect that the neutron stars would drift, although the binary pulsars seen in our galaxy don't have high proper motion or high velocities. There are models that, certainly neutron stars have high velocities. And so one might expect that they would drift out from the galaxy over the billion year time it would take for them to merge. Or another possibility is that these are binary neutron stars in globular clusters, and those tend to be located outside of the center. So I think that's another piece of evidence that we're seeing mergers with these short bursts. This one was a bright burst. It was 10 times brighter than the previous one, and it had a very bright afterglow. And this is, I told you in the first day that a lot of the plots I'll show you have flaring afterglow, even though it only occurs in about 10% of the bursts. And that's because it's quite interesting when we see the flaring. And this this was a very, I think, important and interesting afterglow light curve. This is the bat signal. I'll show you later that there's a kind of soft flare that occurred at 100 seconds. And then it fell off very steeply, the same like for the first burst. And this seemed to fit with what you might expect, because you wouldn't expect there to be much gas around an emerging system. But then it flattened out. And then there was quite a big flare out at about 20,000 seconds. And then we actually got Chandra data where it was falling off at the end. Again, it was an elliptical with very low star formation rate. This one had even lower limits on the star formation rate, and the redshift of 0.26.
Is there a mass estimate for
the elliptical? Well, here's L star, but I don't know what the mass is. There may be one. I don't know what it is, but it's a big galaxy.
Did you have a star formation rate limit on this one? I assume they looked and they saw no reach off the line.
Yes.
But what about the first one?
Yes, there was also a limit. I think it was 0.2. Okay. I might not have.
Reach off the scene from either.
Right.
Neither had active evidence of star formation.
Right.
Okay.
And we actually did our own limit because we looked at it with the UV optical telescope, and we put a limit on star formation with the UV emission from the galaxy. But this is actually the published number for it. Okay. And I have interesting thing is the first three that we saw provided the best evidence about what the origin of short bursts were. The ones we've seen since then have made it, the whole picture seem more complex, but I'll go through that. This is 050813. The first image, there was no optical transient or radio transient. Well, I didn't mention on the previous one there was a VLA detection. That's important to point out. There was a radio detection. There was no radio or optical. So this, all we have again is the XRT circle. Can't tell which galaxy it is. There were several, and there's a cluster at a redshift of 0.7. So that seemed, it's a little bit further than the others, but still seemed kind of consistent. Probably might have come from an elliptical. But at the Washington Burst meeting at the end of November, Ido Berger, on behalf of the Caltech group, showed a refined analysis of the error circle. And I don't have the image. He's holding on to it carefully because they're just trying to publish it, I think, in Nature. But I can tell you that the image is offset and smaller, and it doesn't include any of those bright galaxies in the cluster. And there is a very faint galaxy there, you can just imagine in your mind, at a redshift of 1.8. It's the only galaxy within this refined error circle. We've also been working with them, trying to understand. I think they did their astrometry right, and the error circle is correct. And so we'll have to wait and see how this plays out. That galaxy at 1.8 seems to be part of a cluster. There's several galaxies that they found at about the same redshift. So that's a very high redshift. I put it in my table, but it's not even on this chart yet. And it kind of throws into question what the distance scale is for short bursts.
How short and hard is it? You don't really have a hardness number here.
Yeah.
Would this just be a short long burst?
Yeah. All of these have hard spectra. This one had a duration of 0.6, and it had this very common feature for the short hard burst that we learned from Batsy, which is the first, hard spike, and then there's some emission after that. So yeah, it's a good point. Any one of these could be on the tail of the long burst distribution. Well, I guess you were at the conference, so you heard, you know as much as I do. Yeah. I mean, we work closely with that group, but they're holding this close to the vest. So look forward to seeing the paper come out. But they do careful work. I'm sure. I believe their position is correct. A new burst that just came out that we just detected on first, and it was very bright. It's about 10 times brighter than the other one, so it's 100 times brighter than the first one. And they're very short duration spikes in it. Since it was so bright, it was nicely resolved. And this is something else that was seen in Batsy data for the short burst, that there's one particular big spike, but when there's enough statistics, it can be resolved into pulses. T90 of 1.4, you can see that there's some emission out here. And so there was an optical transient for this, and the redshift turns out to be 0.5. And the galaxy type, see if it's on here. Well, I didn't write it on here, but it's a star-forming galaxy. Don't have HST data to show where it is in the galaxy. HST was not able to observe that position at the time because of its gyro constraints, but we are going to get an observation later to try to see where it is in the galaxy. And here's a new paper that Alicia Soderberg has written on this burst, and just showing there was a radio upper limits and a detection. She postulates a forward and reverse shocks. There's emission, good limits on there being no supernova. And in the X-ray, there's a sort of evidence of an additional energy injection event in 3 hours. Okay, so now we'll turn to the summary of what all we've seen. There have been quite a few other bursts that we didn't see in X-rays. There were two of those. So these were the first three that I showed you, that each one of them had some kind of supporting evidence of a merger model. Or I don't know what happened to the R's here. But in the very, even if there isn't any direct evidence of mergers, there certainly is very strong evidence that these are not due to collapsars or massive stars or supernovae. This one, redshift of 1.8, is a very faint galaxy. If it's really that far, it would have higher EISO. I'm listing here the EISOs. I'll talk about beaming in a couple of minutes, but don't know for sure how much beaming there is in these short bursts, so I'll calculate EISO. If you calculate the isotropic energy for a long burst, you probably know that number is like 10 to the 53. So these are very much less luminous than those. And we've had other short burst detections since then, and we've had a couple that had really good X-ray observations right after the burst to detect anything. We also had a short soft burst, which was in the galactic plane, and probably is not a quote gamma ray burst at all. It may be a not even a super flare, but a sort of normal flare from a new SGR. There hasn't been another flare from that spot in the sky, so we don't know for sure if that is a new SGR or not. But since it was right in the plane, it seems suspicious. I listed here a burst that was seen by the IPN which this is a way of using multiple satellites to get in general, much bigger error circle. And I'll show you those data in a second. And then there have been two other ones in December, the one that I talked about, 1221. There are also two events that have durations longer than 3 seconds. The typical break time between short and long is 2 seconds. And these have T90s, like this one that we saw on the 27th, had a T90 of 4.5 seconds, I believe. So it didn't look like a short burst, but you look at the light curve for that burst, and there's a short pulse, and then there's bumpy emission after that. And it may well be a short burst, don't know for sure, and there's only a galaxy that's seen. So I think the picture is fairly rich and maybe a bit confusing at this point, exactly what the distance scale is to short bursts. Are there some SGR super flares hiding in this? I'm going to talk about that a little bit later this morning. And what's going on with these other events?
You know, because you have the NE ISO, which is much lower than for the long burst. Is there X-ray and radio and also the rest of it shifted down too for us, so is it much lower than?
Yes.
And does it scale for?
Yes. The afterglow emission tends to be, in long bursts, the afterglow can be comparable to the prompt emission, but it tends to, on average, be a factor of 2 to 10 less. And that's the same thing. If you integrate up the total afterglow emission on the short burst, it's similar. So they're also, relatively fainter. I made a little plot here of EISO versus T90, and I corrected it into the rest frame. Just to show you that there's really a different class for the short burst. It's actually quite interesting. I just made this a week ago, and there's a pretty strong trend. Now, there are observational biases that, would tend to have a kind of relationship like this, but there's no reason why there couldn't be a very underluminous class of long bursts or of short bursts that would fall down in this region. They'd be very nearby when we detected them. So, but if they were nearby, they could fall here. And there is actually one event down here at 10 to the 47 in about 10 seconds, which is 980425. So we know of this one very underluminous gamma ray burst, not from SWIFT, but from a long time ago. But the main purpose of this is to show that they're, not in addition to being shorter duration, they also are much less luminous, mostly because they're close by. Now, the two interests, I don't know if you can see that, not very well. These plots, I'm showing the main pulse on a much longer time scale for the heady burst in 50724. And both of these have afterglow emission. It's seen in the gamma rays, but it's actually softer. It's the soft band for both heady and for SWIFT. The SWIFT one, I think you can see the best. And it lasts for about 100 seconds. It's a fairly smooth light curve, has a softer spectrum. If you look back in the BATSE data set, and Valerie Connaughton did work like this, and there were other people who have done work, and you add up lots of different bursts piled up on top of each other for short bursts, you do see that there's evidence for emission at longer time scales. So we've seen two of these. It may be that this is a common feature of short bursts, at least in some fraction of the bursts. We don't know yet since the statistics are small. What are some of the possible causes of this? You could have external clumps, basically the jet is running into material. You could have continued central engine activity. And Andrew McFadden has published this, or hasn't published it yet, but has written an AstroPH paper, which postulates that there could be, the whole mechanism is not a merger, but it's an accretion-induced collapse of a neutron star, accreting matter from a giant in a close orbit. In this case, in their model, they had a red giant. And as the shock wave goes out, it interacts with the surface of the star, creating an afterglow pulse like this. So, you know, it's an interesting idea that they have. There's certainly no strong evidence that, you know, it's not compelling that you need to have an idea like that, a model like that. I'd like to look at some of the general characteristics of short bursts. First of all, what about jet breaks and beaming? On 05/07/09, here are all the data. I guess it's not plotted here, but these are radio limits. These are the red is X-ray, and green are the optical. And although the data are not, there's not strong evidence, there is a hint of a jet break here. And if you interpret that as a jet break, you end up with an opening angle of 20 degrees. GROW 724. It's hard to say if there's a jet break because of this flaring that went on, but we do have Chandra data out at late times, and it doesn't look like there's a jet break, and it goes out to pretty late times. And this would imply a jet angle of more than 40 degrees. Now, for long bursts, the typical angles are a few degrees or 5 degrees, and so it looks like there's less beaming going on for the short bursts.
Are those non-detection in the radio for 0507?
Yes. Those are upper limits.
Is that a problem?
I mean, well, it is. Yeah, this is a you know, sort of fireball model that they've put together here, and it is, yes. It's right at the, you know, it's really violating these limits. So it makes one wonder if the whole fit is a good one or not. We have some really nice Chandra observation for 12/21, and that's been going out for many weeks after the burst. Don't have the data yet, don't even know what the answer is, but you know, we'll be able to make a good either limit on beaming or show that there is beaming, but it'll be a big opening angle. Even I know that already. Well, this is the distribution of opening angles. This is again from Alicia's paper, and we have a limit and a couple of cases where it's been measured, but it looks like it's quite a bit larger opening angle than the long bursts. And then through the modeling of the afterglow, especially for this is for 12/21, the best job was done. I don't know if you noticed, I think I had it on the previous one of these charts for well, she was able to make an estimate of the density of the medium around the star in this paper. And it looks like the circumburst densities are lower for the short bursts than they are for the long bursts. And I refer you to this paper if you're interested in seeing exactly how that was derived. So I would like to spend a couple of view graphs seeing what the implications are for LIGO. We had an interesting discussion over dinner last night, you know, how can we ever prove for sure that we're seeing neutron star mergers and that's what's causing the short bursts, or that it's not neutron star mergers, maybe it's accretion-induced collapse? And of course, the ultimate answer would be a detection of gravitational waves coincident with a gamma-ray burst. LIGO would see mergers, a chirp signal like this, even for mergers that we didn't have the burst for, because, you know, if they are beamed, it looks like they are at least somewhat, there'll be many more that are occurring, 10 to hundreds times more of them than we see as bursts. But the ultimate prize here would be seeing a chirp at the same time that we see a short burst, and that would really nail it. Now, we don't necessarily have to wait for LIGO, and I'll show you in a minute what the rates will be. Looks like you probably need advanced LIGO, in my opinion, although other people have different opinions. There may be other ways to nail this down a lot better. If there was a very nearby short burst, you know, very close, say 10 times closer, we might get one of those over the length that SWIFT is up, or at least 2 or 3 times closer. Then you could do very deep studies in the optical. Look if there's any evidence for radioactivity, like Shree has a paper on macronovae, or any signature of a supernova, and you know, it would begin to give you some faith and a merger model for these short bursts, or it might rule it out. So the range, just based on what we've seen in the bat right now, and then if you postulate that all of the short bursts that Batsy sees are also due to mergers, then you have 10 to 50 per gigaparsec per year. Now you need to correct for beaming angles to see how many mergers are going on. And so the correction goes from about 30 to 130 by my estimation.
I'm sorry, let me understand. Why can't the correction be 1? You didn't show any evidence for beaming.
Well, I mean,
I don't know if you call
it from 1 to 100 rather than 30 to 100. How do you know there's any beaming at all?
0709 had a hint of beaming.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but I guess as a limit, I guess you're right. This could go from 1 to 100.
Well, I don't know. You haven't shown them.
No, I think you're right. I think I was just, I've done this recently. I think 30 really isn't the lower limit. It could be 1.
Yeah.
Could be 1. So let's factor that in when we're doing, revise this number. So that would mean that assuming all short bursts are due to mergers, the merger rate would go from 10 to 5,000. Per gigaparsec per year. And so advanced LIGO is sensitive to about 300 megaparsecs, and so the advanced LIGO detection rate would go from, I guess, about 0.1 or 0.0 or 0.3 to greater than 500. So it's even for advanced LIGO, the numbers are, you know, there's a pretty broad range. It could be seeing a chirp signal from these mergers once a day, or you know, it could take several years to see one. I'll talk more about this Nacar et al. Paper. I don't know if anyone else is going to be addressing that during your workshop, but I have some charts which has a very much higher number.
But I guess the reason I'm hammering a little bit is,
yes,
you know, I think it's really important to get the lower limit firm based on the data you've got and the redshift you have. Right? There's a clear, just no nonsense, hard to debate number that I think you guys can come up with.
Yes.
And if that's still only 1 for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
I mean, people should know that, right? So
yeah.
My feeling is that, you know, the problem is the minute you put in meaning that's uncertain, you sort of muddy the beautiful data you have, where you actually have a rock solid, you know,
yeah,
a rock solid prediction.
Well, it is actually, you can actually see on this chart what that number would be.
Yeah.
Just from the few we've seen in the bat, it's, you know, it's 10 per gigaparsec per year. And so if there's no beaming,
yeah,
that's the number.
Well, the things for the limits in the Nacar paper, the lower limit is about 10 per cubic gigaparsec per year, which is the first thing that the reduction basically obviously you have.
Right.
And the upper limit, which is about
10 to the 5,
would be if all, core class supernovae create neutron stars, where we would end up in neutron stars and binary mergers.
Yeah.
No, also pretty extreme. So probably the truth is somewhere in between, at the order of 10 to the 3 for the gigaparsec per year.
And I'll discuss. And I'll discuss this 10 to the 5 number that they come up with. I'll show you that in a minute. It's not, you know, it's based on modeling, but it's also based somewhat on data or some guesses at what the data are hinting at. So one of the questions is, you know, will SWIFT still be up when Advanced LIGO is there? Advanced LIGO will be online, I think, around 2012. And so, this is more for your amusement than anything else. We recently did the SWIFT orbit decay calculation. So one of the rules you have at NASA is you're not allowed to launch a small satellite without a propulsion system, or any size satellite, actually big is worse, without a propulsion system if it's going to stay in orbit more than 25 years. And at the time we launched, there was a higher prediction for what the solar activity would be in the coming solar maximum. And you know, in the year since we launched, that number has dropped, and so this is the most recent orbital decay curve. And actually, it puts our most this is the lower limit, best guess, and upper limit. It puts our most likely best guess number out past 25 years, so this would have gotten us in trouble, but you know, I'm certainly happy to have it up for a long time. It looks like the minimum amount of time, you know, SWIFT will be up through 2022. That doesn't mean it'll be funded and turned on and all the hardware will be working that long. But one thing you learn in the space business is that electronic components tend to fail in the first months or first year of orbit. Once you get past that time, they usually last for 10 or, you know, 5 or 10 years. So even though we built the mission to last for only 2 or 3 years in terms of the reliability of the components, it's quite likely that we'll still be in orbit and able to work in 2012 if we can get NASA to fund it that long. So just for your amusement, I'll go over this paper in a little bit more detail by Nacar. And so the idea here is that trying to estimate how long after this neutron star system is created, the merger would occur, and basically see what the rates are. And by comparing comparing to the Batsy log n log s, assuming that the birth of the neutron stars follows the star formation rate, and then also factoring in this very tantalizing result that Neil Tanver has come up with, where he correlates the short hard burst positions on the sky and finds correlation with nearby structure galaxies for 5% of the Batsy short bursts at a redshift of 0.025. That's pretty speculative, but it's an interesting paper. But what does this mean? This means that there may be a population of very subluminous short bursts, or very subluminous mergers. There would be a lot of them. There's a bunch nearby us, they fill space, and so you could have quite a few more. So when they go through their modeling, they come up with a merger time of greater than 3 gigayears, and a rate that could be as high as 10 to the 5. And it says in their paper, as Yanni was pointing out, the rate could be anywhere from 10 to 10 to the 5 per gigayear, per gigaparsec per year. And the point of this is that there are a lot of these, there could be a lot of these, they're showing, that that we just don't see because they're very subluminous. Now, 10 to the 5 per year doesn't agree with, the 3 galactic neutron star systems in the galaxy. That would give you a fairly broad, there's high uncertainty there, but it's 200 to 3,000 per gigaparsec per year. And there's a recent paper that Josh Grinley points out that, those are neutron stars that are both born in supernovae, binary pulsars, but there are neutron star systems in globular clusters where it's an exchange interaction where you capture the other neutron star, from a neutron star that exists. And this could actually be the dominant population. And in principle, you could support or you could believe a number as high as 10 to the 5th per gigaparsec per year.
These results for the nearby, maybe subluminous short hard bursts, can those be just SGRs or something?
Yes. They could be. Let me talk about SGRs a little bit later. We don't see, there are enough short bursts now where we've been able to look in error boxes, not just since SWIFT, but also back in the IPN days, where there are some arc minute size error boxes. And we don't see any, for the ones that we've looked at, we haven't found nearby galaxies with one exception. And so there's some limits you can put there. But I think your basic point is correct, that at the 5% level, these could be SGR events.
So can I just get this right? They looked at which three galactic neutron star systems? They're looking at the two short ones and
the
millisecond. Three observed. So are they looking at the three ones with? Are there three that have? If that means, so someone can correct me. How many have more than merger times of 3 gigayears? Only one.
These don't have 3 gigayear merger times. These are much lower times. The two are the binary pulsars.
They threw out because there's more than, unless we've lost more than one. I mean, we had 5. We lost one because it was a white dwarf. And there was 4. We gained one. So I'm not sure where they got their sample of 3 is my only one confusion. Second is they didn't got a rate off of those 3.
Well,
There's so many things wrong that I'm not even sure where to start.
Chris, I mean, that's the game in which the LIGO people have to play, right?
So the LIGO people play the game of, we want to see, they actually look at one. They look at the closest, the newest discovered one,
correct.
Determines the entire rate.
That's correct.
You dominate by the closest one.
And so what people did with that is, I mean, this is Vicky Taliaferro pushing this more than others, is then you push towards, you have to make lots of short duration mergers. But that's not what, you know, you had to actually come up with new mechanisms to make it that way. The other way is to say, that's one, and you know, let's just do theory and say what the theory answer is. That theory answer would produce a lot more long merger rates. I'm not quite sure, have they thought about all this when they did this paper, or did they just
Would you trust more at this stage the theory or the observations?
Oh, I would not trust either very much, but I would never trust an observation based on one event. And that's what, if you say you're taking a rate from the observations, it really is based on one.
Okay, and it's not like it's not an error.
So the error there is zero, the answer could be anything you want.
No, maybe it's an order of magnitude error, but it's still smaller than the theoretical error.
No, I do not think, I actually would disagree with that statement very strongly.
Yes.
I think so in that sense, that's a bad thing. I mean, I think it's a bad game to play. And in fact, what that would have told you is that if I just believe that, then I would say I would not expect any short bursts in elliptical galaxies, because if I just use that one sample, all of the mergers happen in a million years. But that's not what we believe. I mean, I don't trust population synthesis, but population synthesis would predict something that is more like what we're believing from what we're seeing in the short bursts. So I would actually say, if the short bursts are neutron star mergers, then it would have been better to trust the theory, because the theory gave the right prediction, not the observation.
I would agree with your first statement that we have to say there's a lot of error in both the theory and the observation at this stage.
But this is the problem, is I think they're picking certain things they want to believe, and then they say, look, we have an issue. Well, yeah, if I can always take facts in astronomy and say I have an issue. Is it true? I don't know. I mean, it's more, you take a lot of wrong facts and you'll have something that comes out wrong.
I think, just thinking about observations, okay, but let's get away from the knocker. I think that we will end up with evidence for beaming. We have some data we're taking with Chandra, which does show a hint of a break. There was a hint of a break for the 0709. One, it isn't a stretch to say that most, or a good fraction, maybe most of the, maybe a high fraction of the BATSE short bursts are in the same category. The light curves look the same. The spectra look the same. They're all the same, if it looks like a duck. And so, it's certainly the very lowest limit that you could take, that you would produce, would be 10 per gigaparsec per year. But it's not much of a stretch to say that number, might be certainly 100 or 1,000 or a few thousand even. I would say that's the best guess number now from the observational evidence that we have, because this would be 50, and this might be 100 or so. So, if you believe the NOCR work, you end up with a LIGO 1 detection rate of 3 per year. So we'll know that pretty soon when the enhanced LIGO comes online next year.
Just remember that it's not their preferred rate, 10 to the 5 gigaparsec per year. It's just a very conservative upper limit.
Okay. That's fine. And actually, okay, to tell you, I've heard two talks on this. One of them, the first talk I heard really said that, there's kind of a hint that we're going to see a lot more mergers than we thought. And then at the Washington AAS, it was much more leaning toward lower numbers. So I think the story is changing a little bit. So now I wanted to switch to the SGR flare that we saw and what we might say about short bursts caused by magnetars. So this was on December 27th of 2004. We had just turned on, and not only SWIFT, but many satellites detected this extremely strong pulse of gamma rays from SGR 1806-20. And this is a plot from the RESI satellite. It has kind of the nicest plot I could find. And on this scale, you know, this spike would go up about a kilometer. But all of these instruments are built for burst work, so they recover quickly. The SWIFT bat also did this. And so this lasted a quarter of a second at extremely high counting rate, and then came down, recovered right away, and you could see the pulsations of the spinning neutron star, you know, as time went on for hundreds of seconds. It was the brightest gamma ray pulse that's ever been detected from any object. You know, of course, it's far less luminous than a gamma ray burst since it's so nearby, but it was much brighter. It bounced off the moon and gave a reflected signal in most detectors, caused an ionospheric disturbance that was measured. There was a couple of tiny little particle detectors that were able to, that have a very low efficiency for detecting gamma rays, but do detect gamma rays. And one of them was on GeoTail, and here's the, you can't read this in Japanese, but it lasted a quarter of a second. Here's the main pulse. It has a very short, Ken can read it. Except you can't read it because of the resolution on the screen. It has a very short rise time, and then this one main pulse and dying away quickly. So that seems to be what a light curve looks like for one of these short super flares. We've got lots of examples of flares from SGRs, but the super flares are different. There have been three observed to date. This one's about a factor of 100 brighter than the other two. The normal SGR flare is a fairly soft pulse. This has a hard spectrum. It looks identical to a short hard burst. So it had 100 times the luminosity of the previous SGR giant flares, including the March 5th, 1979 that everybody remembers, you know, from when they were young. But this was 100 times more luminous than that. It had a luminosity and gamma rays of 10 to the 46 ergs. And, you know, this is almost certainly powered by magnetic field reconnection or some kind of magnetic field energy source. The external field is 10 to the 15 gauss, typically, in these magnetars. The internal field may be 10 times that. So there's plenty of energy available to tap by a factor of 100 or 1,000 to produce this kind of gamma ray flare. It's still pretty remarkable that this comes out as a gamma ray flash. And so this immediately led to the idea that giant flares in nearby galaxies could explain some of the short hard bursts. SWIFT could detect a flare out to 60 megaparsecs for the bat, and would see the tail out to 20 megaparsecs with the XRT. We've been looking in every short burst localization that we get to see if there's a nearby galaxy. There haven't been any. There have been searches in the BATSE. There are about five or so BATSE. No, BATSE was part of it, but the location came from the Interplanetary Network, where you compare the arrival time of the signal at several satellites. You can come up with a few arc-minute-sized boxes. There weren't any, really nearby galaxies in those. I'll show you one case where we think there might have been. And so we've been looking, I've been doing some of this, and other people at Goddard, and I'm sure people around the world, looking at the light curves from all the BATSE short hard bursts. BATSE saw 240 short bursts. There are a lot of nice data. I'm trying to see, you know, are there some of them that look just like an SGR flare in some way? Is there some characteristic that you can pick out just from the light curves? The answer is, wow, a lot of them look like that. So I think you really can't say much about SGR flares causing short hard bursts from the light curves by themselves. There's a full 30% of the bursts that have a very fast rise time and a single main pulse in the BATSE data set. So there's almost 100 of them that look like, that have the same signature. On the other hand, the short bursts that we're seeing with BAT also, you know, very often have this. So I think a neutron star merger signal the time structure in the gamma rays is the same as what you would see for SGR flare.
I just want to comment that in the previous time that flare from SGR is minus 20, there was a time scale and the light curve after the initial hard spike and millisecond time scale. It varied by.
You mean the structure on the rise time? On the
well, after it rise, then, you know, there is a dip and recovery where the dip is like a factor of 30 and the time scale is a millisecond.
Yeah.
So it's not a single spike.
Right.
If it goes further away and you couldn't saturate all the instruments, you could see structure.
Right. That's exactly what I was going to say, because we published that, you know, that showed the structure, and there were others. So if it were very nearby, you would see that. But if it were farther away, say at 60 megaparsecs, this is exactly what it would look like, because you wouldn't be able to resolve that very fine structure. There's also a rise time measurement, you know, from the bat. But you wouldn't have the statistics to see that. So I think it would look just like this in your detector. And then just wanted to point out this one case. And it's not, it really doesn't nail anything. It's just more of a hint than anything else. And one thing we've learned over the years with these IPN boxes is they're large enough that they're going to include interesting objects in many cases. But this one was particularly interesting. This is not a swift burst. This was localized. RESI was one of the satellites that detected it, and CONUS. And so there's this IPN error box on the sky. It's many tens of arc minutes, square arc minutes in size. But here it lies right in the field of M81 and M82. Now, actually, the galaxies are not right in the error box. So you know, is this a hint that M81 may have had an SGR that we saw? I'll leave it up to you to see what you think. But certainly no strong evidence that we're seeing a burst from either of those galaxies.
You know, there's a large tidal from M81 because it's right in that box.
There's a large what?
If you look to the lower left of M81,
yes,
it'll go left and down.
Yeah, how far?
There, that little dot is a dwarf galaxy.
This one here?
No, down further. There, that thing. So there's a big tidal arm that comes out of the north end of M81.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Wraps around the right side and goes down to that dwarf. Yeah.
Like that.
Yep.
Okay. So there is a gas associated with M81 that goes right through this error box.
If you look at there's Min Young.
Okay.
It's 21 centimeter maps.
Okay. Where would you most likely think you'd find the SGR? It would be, you know, right there. But you know, it could be anywhere. Okay. So that's all I had to say about short bursts and SGRs. And I was going to close by talking a little bit, just a couple of view graphs about the supernova observations we've been making. In fact, we started out, we didn't even think much about it, but we have a very capable UV telescope. Hubble does nice supernova observations with its UV capability, but it isn't able to follow a lot of supernovae. And so we've made a little industry of following up interesting supernovae. 1As, 1Bs, we're very, you know, since we're a burst team, we're really interested in the hypernovae and the 1Bs and 1Cs. Whenever there's one like that, we go look at it. But we've also looked at type 2s and type 1As. And one of the best observations we've made was for supernova 2005 AM. And you can see the UVOT is basically a photometer, a multiband photometer, but it has grisms, and so we're able to do spectroscopy when we have bright enough sources, brighter than 17th magnitude. And so the really nice spectroscopy that's been done, sort of medium resolution spectroscopy. And then another thing that I think this is a unique capability of SWIFT is we're able to observe often enough to get the UV and, you know, visible light curve for supernovae. We go back and sample it over and over again, which is really hard to do with, hard to get the time to do that with HST. And then recently we've been looking at 2005 KE. We have a kind of interesting result there. So here's the picture in the UVOT. there's a detection that we have in X-rays. It occurred about the maximum was about 40 days after the, this is a type 1A. So it's the first detection of a type 1A in X-rays. I'm not talking about, this is probably due to shock interaction with the circumstellar matter, not due to radioactive decay downscattered X-rays. I don't know if you can see it. It's blocked by the podium here. I didn't write it on the chart. It's probably one of the most important things to point out. It's a 3.5 sigma detection. So it's not extremely firm. But if you believe that, you end up with a mass loss rate for the progenitor of 6 times 10 to the minus 6 and circumstellar density of 8 times 10 to the 7. There is one thing that we actually had this result before we realized what the UVOT light curve was going to look at, mostly because we hadn't gotten around to analyzing the data. And so I think that this adds a lot of strength to that detection. Here the UV light curves we've measured with SWIFT, all these different supernovae. It's really nice how well they fall on top of each other. This has been pointed out by previous people, but I think we have better data than anyone has just to show that. Except for KE, which had this tail that started coming out in the UV, and that joined smoothly into the X-ray detection. So I think there's pretty good idea that there really was a shock interaction with the circumstellar material, and that we saw both UV emission from that and X-rays. And that's it. Thank you.
Trying to understand.
This one?
So for these supernovae, I assume other people have done things in the optical, so they have different measurements. So your UV
These were all, we tend to look at bright nearby, ones that we catch early and that are reasonably bright. So they have good optical data.
But what's your channel, what is your channel width here? This is, when you're plotting this magnitude, this is
the sum of three UV filters. I think it goes from 160 nanometers to, I'm not sure what the upper limit is, but it's the sum of the three UV bands that we have. And so that's what we're plotting here.
Mm-hmm.
So it fits in well with what you would guess. Yeah, there's a nice paper that Stefan Immler has written, and it has the same comment about that.
So prior to SWIFT, were there any associations of short bursts with elliptical galaxies?
No. No. If you look at the history of even prior to the realization that bursts were cosmological, it was mainly promoted by Bogdanchinsky, the idea that they might be. And in those early papers, the idea for the long bursts that he was thinking about were neutron star mergers. And that pretty much went out the window when we started localizing the long bursts in star-forming galaxies. But this model has been around for a long time, since the early 80s, the idea that the gamma-ray bursts could be caused by mergers. Before, and also before the SWIFT observations and the heavy observations, it was realized that the time scale for the gamma-ray pulse coming out, the burst, would be shorter for a merger than for a collapsar. The collapsar, if you go through the computer simulations like some of you in the room do, and Sandy's and people like that, and Andrew McCabe, you come up with tens of seconds as the typical time scale to produce the burst. And so it fits in with what's seen for the duration distribution. It's really hard to make a fraction of a second pulse of gamma rays from the collapsar. And so
even before we, saw bursts coming from elliptical galaxies, people kind of had their hopes pinned on merging neutron stars for the short bursts. And so, it actually sort of fit like a glove. And that's dangerous, too, because expecting it to look like that, it kind of looks like that's what it is, and so then you don't pay attention to other possibilities. So I think it's really nice that Andrew wrote this paper that had an accretion-induced collapse, and there are other people that are looking at other models.
Would you say that there are no selection effects against finding short-duration gamma bursts in very bright star-forming galaxies?
I don't think there's any selection effect for that, because those neither star-forming nor ellipticals make bright X-ray sources. And so it's nothing like the brightness of the afterglow. And so when we get an X-ray afterglow, it's really independent of where it is on the sky, whether it's in a galaxy at all or a star forming an elliptical. So I don't think there's any selection effect like that.
I wonder about this accretion-induced collapse model. So if it's a giant as a companion, wouldn't you see a lot of material? I mean, you have an afterglow which will show hydrogen, etc.
Well, so the burst is coming from the neutron star that collapses to a black hole.
Yeah, but it's a big giant envelope nearby.
Yes. And so you mean a signature like in the afterglow?
Yes.
Yes. In addition to this, I see what you're saying. In addition to the signature of the reprocessing of the shock against the surface of the star, that there would be more material in that whole environment, because this is a close binary system. Well, actually, the afterglows, especially for 0724, I made this comment that you actually see a longer afterglow decay curve than one might expect for a really rarefied medium around a bare merger system. And so, this might actually support, in a way, a model where there's more gas around the system than you'd find in a billion-year-old merging binary.
Well, probably in a system like that, if it's accretion-induced collapse and the reaction to the binary companion would be within the orbital plane, and therefore the angular momentum would be perpendicular to that plane, so if you have even a mildly convicted jet, then most of the afterglow would be in a direction not pointing to the companion. So it's not clear whether it would have a lot of effect on the environment into which the afterglow would be propagating. And even if there were plant index in the medium, it would still be very hard to produce an active like that.
Well, you still have a lot of giant rings. So they're too contented. Like, everything around would be full at least of a giant ring.
Well, it could potentially, but that would not be consistent with the current estimates of very low density in the environment, although at this point, probably not that very reliable. It's an interesting point.
I guess it's the shock wave of the whole explosion that's hitting this companion, and not the jet. I didn't look carefully at the paper, but I'm just thinking now.
At least in one of the two cases, there were two cases of these late-time bombs peaking at several tens of seconds, softer emission, and so on, that this collision with the companion was supposed to explain. Now, at least in one of these two cases, you have comparable energy in the software component. So
yes.
If it's near the rotational equator, and you have a covering factor, optimistically 10%, not a huge covering factor, then to have comparable energy in the jet and near the equator hitting the companion, it's kind of hard to get.
Sounds like a stretch, but.
Well, but on the other hand, he's saying that the short gamma ray bursts, the jets are not that much beamed. So, if the angle is large, then you should.
How do you launch a relativistic outflow that is not beamed? It's not easy. Some degree of beaming you probably need, and even if it's mild, even if it's 30 degrees, and stale at around 90 degrees and 60 degrees, it's hard to get a whole lot of energy. Basically, you want the accretion, like to launch a jet and have some accretion disk. You don't expect the material to be launched through the accretion disk, especially and the torus. But on the other hand, you can set a black hole, you have a magnet. And actually, in order to have much emission come out, since the companion would be fairly close by, in order for the optical depth not to be too large, then it would help a lot if it would be magnetically dominated optics. Rather than instead that the black hole, some magnet is forming a magnetic wing, it might potentially be predominantly in the rotational equators.
At least that's an option for thinking about this. You know, can I ask a little bit about the super, how many of these super that you're going to see? So, in terms of your last slide, there were a lot, you've done 20 or something. Can you give us a sense of what your real constraints are? Obviously, there's people are finding a lot of them, so.
Yeah, it's a little less than 20, but.
You're more constrained by what you can do.
Right. Well, to tell you the truth, been blundering into this, and we've been a lot more systematic about it lately. And so recently we've been observing more of them and paying more attention to trying to select the best ones and try to use our time as wisely as possible.
So
actually, Elvis on the team that's been helping us.
But what was the plan anyway? I mean, most of the time you're not looking at a GRP. So what was the intent of the 24/7 of the UDOT anyway?
Okay.
What was the plan for what you were
going to
do
with it? So, prior to launch, we predicted that we would spend more than half of our time looking at the gamma ray bursts. Not just the recent one that went off, but going off, looking up for a long time. And we are doing that, and we're spending about 40%. So it's not that different from what we predicted. And we're going to fill the rest of the time with targets of opportunity for transients and, things that you're interested in, and a lot of people are, and also targets of opportunity of any kinds of, not just targets of opportunity, but also steady sources, some kind of observing program to fill those in. And so what's happened is that we've observed, the real numbers are that we're observing 40% of the time on gamma ray bursts, observing about 30% of the time on targets of opportunity. And just for your information, there's a web page and you can propose those. And I've been approving them at a pretty high rate. About two-thirds of them have been approved. But pretty much if it's not conflicting with the burst, if science looks interesting, or I have a little peer review process for that, we go chase it. And then the other 30% have been filling targets. And the way we've been doing that, we will, So as part of the mandate from headquarters, we're not allowed to include that in the GI program for the first 2 years because they wanted it to concentrate on bursts. But we are going to open that up in future years for proposals for people to just look at any source that they're interested in. What we do right now is we have a little peer review process and people just informally put in ideas. Maybe I shouldn't advertise this too much because we get swamped.
That's what you want.
But we want to have the best things to look at,
sure.
So that's why I mentioned it. And so ideas get generated, and then there are actually little proposals written. And we peer review those, and we come up with the targets. The supernovae are in the target of opportunity area.
Well, but except there's so many of them that basically, not really a target of opportunity issue.
Right.
In the sense that it's just a question of how much reserve time you would spend on it.
Right. And so we've been relatively spending more time, and you can see how the numbers have increased, towards the bigger numbers in 2005. We've been spending more time on supernovae than we did early on the mission. But we now have a group of people both in the SWIFT team and outside. Ellen is part of it. We've got Bob Kirshner and Alex Filipenko and quite a few people that are involved in sort of giving advice, almost too much advice. Which ones are the best ones? But actually, the team advice, within the team is a decision that's made if this one is really worth it.
I just remember there was a big SDIS program that was supposed to go after UV spectra of nearby 1As, which of course then couldn't happen. So
right.
So I guess what I'm just wondering, is this after satisfying that demand? Or are you going not far enough into the blue? I guess they were going out to 1,000.
Maybe I'll let other people comment if anyone else.
Data use proposal is coming high this year.
Right.
But I think they need to go through the blue than 3,000.
Would be useful for the community metallistic public.
We try not to be looking at more than one supernova at a time. Of course, if there are two really good ones going off, you know, there has been a time when we're looking at two. And we tend to put more emphasis on hypernovae or 1BCs. If there's anything like that that comes along, we'll go have a look, even if it's pretty far away.
But what's the time resolution for the UVO2? How fast can I count? I mean, what's the time tagging or the photons?
Millisecond.
So they're all time tagging everything, yeah. even in the Grissom mode?
Yes. Yeah, it's a photon by photon system. So we can do good timing. And another thing that we've been trying to do is catch them as early as possible, of course. But, the observatory is flexible enough that we can get on a source within a day, so I think we're able to do that better than HST. So like 2005 AM, we caught really nice and early and caught the whole peak. But, given that there are a lot of supernova people here, if you're interested in this, you can certainly get in touch with me and become involved if you'd like.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. I think as time goes on, I'll also mention that we've already advertised this, in the next opportunity will be for the guest observer program. Targets of opportunity are one kind of proposal that will be accepted. And so I'm guessing there will be, several supernova proposals that will come in, and that will allow there to be funding for funding for somebody. You could, even if you're outside the U.S., you can put in a proposal like this and, provide funding to somebody in the U.S., or at least have the observations done. What else? Anything else about short bursts, SGRs? Sounds like Yanni's quite enthralled with the SGRs.
There are about three different lines of evidence that were suggested so far why only a small fraction of short bursts after galaxy can be associated with FTR giant events. One of them is the best localized short bursts where the paper in the Haritov, they looked at them and saw no galaxy has a pretty good limit, and therefore that they can constrain it. And in about five cases, we didn't see any, so it can't be too much less, so it can't be more than about 20. That line of argument that we suggested in Haritov is just by the locations on the sky, the short galaxy bursts, and the fact that if you take the latest SGR giant flare and you can see it up to about 40 megaparsec or so, then a good fraction of the star formation array in the nearby 40 megaparsec would be in the Virgo cluster, about 30-45%, and then we search for excess of events in the direction of the Virgo cluster and saw none. If anything, was like deficit and not statistically significant, it's consistent with mean isotropic, no excess of events in that direction. That gives you a rough upper limit of about 5%. Yet the third line of argument suggested by Matsaki et al. Is from the spectrum of this spike that lasted about a quarter of a second was more or less thermal. You look at the best spectra of galaxy bursts, and they're not thermal in almost all cases, and that gives you an upper limit of roughly 4%. So it's a level of a few percent. It might be consistent with this Tangirata result, at the level of about 5% or so. It can't be the dominant population of short bursts.
are we starting to put limit or lifetime or, you know, limits on how many of these very bright super flares, you know, but what the time scale would be or the population would be of magnetars that could produce a super flare of that luminosity? Was this a sort of once in 10 year or once in 100 year detection of this extremely bright flare? And how many magnetars do you know exist?
Well, there are four confirmed SGRs. Also very experienced, so the number of magnetars is larger, but at least the SGRs which are known to produce such giant flares are four such confirmed sources. And well, in order to be consistent with these rays, and even though, I mean, that there are three known giant flares in the past 30 years or so in which we could detect them, so but the red would be dominated by the last one since it was so much brighter than the other two, which would be seen to a much larger distance. And the red would be dominated by that. Naively, you might say, okay, maybe once for 30 years, but that would overpredict the red that we would see, and we needed to be about the factor of 10 smaller, so maybe once every 300 years. And then there are various lines of argument. You can say maybe there's some beaming and so on. You can play around with it, but these very bright events cannot be too common, but you should have seen many more short bursts. It would have been dominated by that.
So it may have been a very rare detection that he had of that.
So, any other questions or questions? Income. Thank you.
Thank you.